Hey there, all you guys and gals, all you hepcats, cool kittens, you diesel-powered disciples of cool. This is the Diesel Punk Podcast, the voice of Diesel Punk, and this is your Diesel Punk Roundtable with myself, your host, the artist also known as Big Daddy Cool. You can call me Johnny. And joining us once again, it seems like a lifetime ago that he was with us, but the professor, the Diesel Pope, straight from the Dallas-Fort Worth compound, Mr. Larry Amyet.
Hi, Johnny. Hi, everybody. It's great to be back.
It is great to have you back. And joining us also via the magic of the interwebs, from Memphis, Tennessee, that darling, daring damsel of the skies, Daisy O'Dare.
What's buzzing, cousin? I gotta tell you, I am so glad to be back with you fine fellas tonight.
Well, we are glad to have you with us, and joining me once again is the creator of the Fedora Chronicles, all the way from New Hampshire, my friend and yours, Mr. Eric Fisk.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called Diesel Punk, an electric word, life that means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else, podcasting.
Amen, brother.
Beautiful.
Testify. Can I have a witness from the congregation?
I'm with you.
Hey, man.
I'm with you, brother. I'm with you. So,
well, guys, we are back with the Diesel Punk in Pop Culture Roundtable, and it's been a while. It probably feels longer than it has been.
It's only a month. It's only been a month.
I know. And in that month, though, Eric, you and I have been super busy. I told Larry and Daisy a couple of weeks ago that you and I had decided to start doing every Tuesday night. So we've done shorter podcasts. We've had some interviews. Tony Snipes was on, and that episode went live last week. We've got a great discussion coming up on the podcast. Probably as you're listening to this, you're listening to last week's episode. And so Daisy and Larry, you guys are always, always, always welcome to just dial in on Tuesday nights. We don't have to have a formal roundtable for you guys to join in. Larry, you're one of the founders of this thing. So, the door is always open. You don't even have to knock, my brother.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man.
So, we got some cool stuff going on in the world of pop culture for Diesel Punks. And a lot of discussion has been going on around the forum at Diesel Punks on Facebook about what's it going to take to push Diesel Punk forward as a genre. And, I think, Eric, more and more people are starting to kind of come around to my thinking and our thinking. I keep saying we need a Hollywood studio to actually use the word Diesel Punk in their marketing. But I don't know if you noticed, but some of our forum members have actually suggested something that you and I and Larry and Daisy have talked about before, and that is engaging the people who are already doing Diesel Punk but don't know that they're doing Diesel Punk.
Yeah, exactly.
I.e. the historical reenactors.
Yes, yes. I think the thing, and this has always gotten me into so much trouble in the past, whereas it's like I really sort of have a wide open arms, open door policy when it comes to Diesel Punk. If you are really into the 1930s and 40s jazz era aesthetic, and you want to call yourself a Diesel Punk, you're a Diesel Punk. There's no elitism here. We do not have this sort of notion whereas we need to check all the boxes and we need to check your blood and we need to check your ancestry and see and everything that you've done in the past. And we're not going to interview everybody that you went to high school and college with to make sure that you're a Diesel Punk. it's like, it's sort of like this. It's like if you want to call yourself a member of a specific religion, you don't have to wait for us to baptize you. The fact that you want to be a member of our society, you're more than welcome to. And I think that that's something that really sort of freaks people out, because the thing is that it's like, oh my God, they're so welcoming and friendly. Oh my God, they must want my kidneys and put my body in a bathtub full of ice or something like that. And that's not the case. And if you want to be a diesel
punk, wait a minute. I thought that was a typical Friday night at your house.
You know, let's not talk about the time you and I went to the bus stations looking for runaways. But no.
Now, see, that laugh from Larry sounds like he's entertained that notion once or twice.
I think that we should just dress up in our World War II era uniform and attire, or our Elliot Ness uniforms, and dress like mobsters from the 30s and 40s, and hang out at airports saying, "Have you heard the gospel of John and Eric?" No, I mean, it's like, I think it does throw people off, because the thing is that we want everybody who calls themselves diesel punk to join us.
Absolutely. You made me think of something, and now I completely forgot it, but it'll come back to me later on, I guess. But, you know, speaking of being a diesel punk and loving diesel-y stuff, Larry, you recently published a great review of, you know, I guess it would be considered some diesel foundation material, in that you saw the documentary on Marsden and the Wonder Women.
No, I haven't had a chance to see it yet.
Oh.
It wasn't a review. It was more of a FYI out here. So, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, I thought you had. I wrote my notes like you had.
Yeah. When I read your overview, I thought you had seen it. But tell us all about it. It is on Netflix, I believe.
Professor Marsden and the Wonder Woman?
That's in theaters now.
It's in the theaters, Johnny.
I think John.
It is big time, major motion picture.
Wait a minute! You guys forget. I'm a time traveler.
Okay.
It was on Netflix 9 months.
In your past,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Professor Marsden and the Wonder Woman is a recent film that came out. I believe it was released just a few weeks ago. If I looking at my notes right, let's see. It was released back just October 13th. So we're looking at just about a week ago. It got released. It's getting, well. Let's see. On reviews, it has an 88% freshness on Rotten Tomatoes. So it's getting some pretty good reviews. I don't think it's a smash hit. I haven't looked at the dollars as to what it's bringing in the box office. Daisy, I understand you have some interesting information about some reactions to the movie.
Yes, actually, I was poking around on the Internet Movie Database, because I had seen some internet comments about an article about the movie hinting at this. And William Marston's granddaughter, Chrissy Marston, she has publicly stated that her family completely rejects any claims made in the film and in no way supports this work of fiction.
Hmm.
That's what she's had to say about it. And even though it's being promoted as the true story of William Marston, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Marston, and Olive Byrne, a lot of the film, they're saying a lot of the film is speculative because they did live their lives kind of privately. The director, Angela Robinson, was asked about it at New York Comic Con, and she said, you know, there's a lot of facts that are indisputable about them, but she also feels there's a lot open to interpretation. So as a filmmaker, this was her interpretation of their story. So basically, Johnny, it's not a documentary like you were hoping.
Yeah.
So to kind of catch our listeners up, Professor Marston was the creator of the iconic DC Comics superhero character Wonder Woman, and for all accounts, throughout the life of the character, it's always been told that Wonder Woman was inspired by the two women of his life, his wife and their significant other, Olive, and that Wonder Woman was an amalgamation of the two characters. So that that's kind of our Dieselpunk connection there. He created Wonder Woman back, at the height of World War II.
Now, interesting. Now, one has to wonder, and I think what I've read about accuracy and inaccuracy, yeah, there's a lot of it that they took liberty with, but mostly about his career more than anything. But the relationship between Elizabeth and Olive, according to the man that wrote Wonder Woman, Bondage and Feminism in the Marston Peter Comics, Noah Brelatsky, I think it's pronounced, of his last name. Y'all know how I butcher names. Noah Brelatsky, he wrote an article for the website The Verge about the movie, saying that while the details about Marston's career are really very speculative, the relationship between Elizabeth and Olive, he said that there's substantial support about them being in a bisexual relationship. That was a very much a polyamorous three-way relationship between the three of them. So interesting. I wish I had seen it yet. I haven't. I'd like to.
No, I haven't seen it yet either. I'd like to give it a look and then reread The Secret History of Wonder Woman to see exactly how close or how far off the mark they got. Which I had read that book last year, but a lot of that isn't fresh in my mind because it's a pretty long one. So I'll have to give it another read after watching this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know what? I might make that one of my weekend movies. I've got a weekend movie jaunt coming up and going to go see the new Blade Runner.
Thank God.
And maybe I'll catch Professor Marsden, because I just took the dive and I signed up for MoviePass. You know, have you guys heard about this service?
Sounds familiar, but no.
I don't know the details. Is that the film service that's kind of like Netflix for movies?
No. Well, kind of.
Netflix kind for of. Theater movies.
There you yes. go. Daisy's heard yes. of it. She's already a member.
Yeah. So this is not a paid endorsement. They are not a sponsor. I'm just like in love with this service. You pay $9.99 a month, and Larry, unlimited movies in the theater. As many movies as you want to go see. The only restriction is you can only go to one per day, and it can't be the same movie twice.
Did you say $9.99 a month?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're hard pressed to buy a ticket.
I know.
One ticket. $9.99.
That's right. So the whole idea of the model is that the theaters make it up in volume, because where they make their profit is on the concessions. There's very little profit margin in the actual tickets. So the idea is you're gonna pull more people into the theater, people who normally would only go see one or two movies a year. Are now going to be, you know, five or six movies a year. And, you know, the people who are like me, who are maybe two or three movies a month, we might now be 4 or 5 movies a month. And so the concession profits, you know, more than make up for the loss leader on the ticket. And actually, you know, they've done the actuarials, they've run the numbers. The theaters are making a profit by participating. So, Eric, when we talked about this last week, I was actually wrong. I had heard that AMC had decided not to participate, but according to the website at MoviePass today, AMC is a participating chain.
Oh, that's so awesome. That's incredible. That's a game changer for me. I think that that's one of those things where it's like, if you review movies like I do for Flicks to Hold You Over on the Fedora Chronicles, that's a no-brainer. And that means that because I have weird shifts working two jobs, I would like to be able to believe that I can go see a movie at any weird time of the day or night, go there when I'm not trolling the local bus stops for runaways, and be able to pick up, you know, go watch a movie or something like that. And it was just like to break up the monotony, but I mean, for me, it's just, why haven't they done this sooner? I don't understand.
Well, you know, I think it took the real success of streaming services like Netflix and Hulu and, you know, the recent release of Filmstruck to really get people to think outside the box, because, you know, Hollywood for a long time has, just like the traditional music industry, you know, when Napster came along and, you know, later a more legitimate platform in iTunes, you know, the music industry was in a panic. They wanted to shut down digital distribution at, you know, however they could. And of course, at the end of the day, you know, Metallica lost on that one. You remember they were the ones that brought the lawsuit, and, you know, they won the day, but they lost the battle against digital distribution. And I was an A&R director for a Nashville record label at the time. And I remember the absolute panic in our offices by people who didn't understand the changing tide. And when Prince, you remember Prince was the first artist to release a new album exclusively on digital.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that changed the entire landscape. And so now the main form of distribution is digital. However, a good thing came out of that. The good thing that came out of that was people have figured out that, okay, yeah, I can consume it digitally, but I don't really own it. And especially with iTunes user agreement, if you use iTunes Match, for example, and there's an album release that is removed from the iTunes store, the next time your account syncs with iTunes, that album is removed from your library. So, you know, people are figuring out that you don't really own the product when you download it digitally. You can enjoy it. It's you know, fun to have on your iPod or your iPhone or, you know, your mobile device. But if you want to really own it, you want to buy the product. So the end result is that we've seen actually an increase in hard product sales, primarily at live shows.
Yeah.
When people go see a live concert, they want to take a piece of the concert with them. And so they buy the product. But the biggest thing that came out of the digital music revolution was the resurgence of vinyl. Who would have thought that iTunes would lead to more people wanting to own and listen to music on vinyl again? You go into, you know, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, you know, any of the major music retailers now, they've got a huge section on of vinyl records. and it's been a huge resurgence. And I think that Netflix and Hulu have ultimately probably had a similar effect on Hollywood in that, yes, you can consume anything you want instantly, stream it instantly, but the more digital we become as a society, the more desire there is for the real life experience, for the high touch. And so I think what will ultimately happen as this movie pass idea catches on and we swing back the other way is that we're going to see more people flocking to the theaters for that movie theater experience.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, Eric, but I absolutely hate watching movies and TVs at home. You know, there are distractions. There's the dogs running around, the kids, you know, my wife asking a million questions. Well, why did he do that? You know, oh, I got to get up and get more popcorn. Or,
yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Stop touching me. You stop touching me. You don't, you know, you don't have that in the movie theater. And one of my profound pleasures is going to the movie theater, like either in the middle of the afternoon or really late at night on a weeknight.
Right.
And being the only person in the entire theater.
That's how I saw Dunkirk. And it was such a incredible experience being in the theater, and they're showing it just for me. And it was like, I mean, Dunkirk was not as good as it could have been or should have been because of the nonlinear storytelling, which we talked about in last week's episode. But it was just such a beautiful movie-going experience with the wide screen and the perfect sound. And nobody asking me a ton of questions like, could you let the dog out? Could you let Abby out so she can pee? Now could you let Daisy out so she can pee too? Can you feed the dogs? Do we feed the dogs? Who's going to unload the dishwasher? None of that. None of that at the theater. What?
Hey, someone's at the door. Oh, honey, it's the Mormons.
Yeah. You know, and it was, you know, hey, honey, the sheriff's office here wants to know, have you been by the bus station again this week? You know, that kind of thing. You know, and I think that you really miss something when, and I love and appreciate being able to watch a movie in the comfort of my own home, so long as it's like one of my comfort films. The perfect example is that this weekend I had a horrible cold. I don't know if you can still hear it or not. I had this horrible cold, and all I wanted to do was just veg out in front of the couch and watch Miller's Crossing. And Miller's Crossing is like one of those things where it's like it's comfort food for the eyes and the ears for me, because it's a perfect film noir or neo-noir, as it were. There's something about just being at home watching a movie that you really love. But the thing is that when you watch it the first time, you really don't want that distraction, and you want the communal experience. I think it's like you laugh harder in a room full of strangers watching a movie for the first time, like a comedy. Or like you cry really hard when you're in a room full of strangers in the dark watching a movie. I don't think you really get that experience. I don't think The Empire Strikes Back or Raiders of the Lost Ark would have been as awesome as it is if I saw it at home for the very first time, surrounded by bright lights coming from the kitchen and the kids running around and whatnot. I think that theaters should never die. Theaters should be maintained and loved and cherished. If you're a moviegoer, if you're an agnostic moviegoer, that's your church, as it were. And the idea of theaters going out of business is a travesty, because it's really the only culture we have in the United States.
Well, it is definitely one of the biggest cultural events. I mean, live theater is still, you know, very much alive, but for the masses, I mean, let's be honest. I did this study years ago. Less than 1% of the population are regular live theater, live show goers. That means that on average, the average person goes to see a live Broadway musical or ballet or opera or a play or a symphony performance or even a big major touring artist concert less than once in their entire lifetime. That's on average. The average person just doesn't go to live theater. So the fallback, the default is the movie theater. And I think this movie pass thing could really revolutionize the movie going experience for a lot of people.
Speaking, you're right. It'd make it a lot easier.
Yeah. I mean, think about it, Daisy. You're paying $10 a month. You don't have to say, okay, can I afford to go to the movies this week, or do I need to wait until next week?
Oh, wait. Well, I'd better go to the movies to use that membership.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're like me, you're going to go to the movies at least once a month anyway. And here in Nashville, movies are, $10 to $11 a ticket. A friend of mine who lives in New York City, it's $17 a ticket. So, when just by having the membership to MoviePass, he saves $7 a month if he does only one movie. He's making money. That's crazy when you think about that, right? So anyway, I'm a big believer in that product, and I really, really love it. And I'll tell you, I'm gonna try to use it to see the new Blade Runner. Larry, have you seen the Blade Runner sequel yet?
I haven't been to a movie in a real long time, so unfortunately not.
Well, that is a shame. I think, Daisy, have you seen it yet, Blade Runner?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, so I think out of our group, Eric is the only one who's seen it. Eric highly recommended it. But it's a shame, Eric, because it still just has not performed in the box office, and it's really a shame because from your lips, it was a beautiful film and a worthy successor to the original.
I think that it's an important movie to see now, especially as we're quickly approaching Halloween, because so many science fiction movies out there today is really nothing more than trying to retell and recap and maybe even top Mary Shelley's original Frankenstein. And this movie does a great job saying exactly what Mary Shelley was trying to say, but it does it right in your face. You should not be playing God with life, bringing life into the world and not taking responsibility for it. You should not be creating brand new life that has never been seen before in the history of the planet Earth, as far as we know, and then making it into a slave race or experiment on it or make it do the kind of dirty jobs or whatever. Whether you want to believe it or not, those are children. Essentially, they may be fully grown, fully formed with memories that have been implanted, but they're still children. And you wouldn't take a toddler or an infant and give it a gun and say, yeah, go shoot those aliens over there or anything like that. And this movie is really so blatant about this is what you when you create life, this is what you have to do. And if you don't, these are the consequences. And it is, I think it is such an important movie to see with everything that's going on in the world of genetics and bioengineering and all like that. It's sort of like, look, if you're a college student and you're thinking about creating life in a laboratory, this is a movie that you really should see. And it picks up 30 years after the original Blade Runner, which I told John doesn't agree with me. I understand he's still wrong, but I still love him. He's a brother. The original Blade Runner was a perfect movie for me. It came at the perfect time in my life, and it's one of those comfort movies. But this has such an important message, and it's not one that I really think that we should ignore. It also talks about what we're doing to the planet. It talks about what we're doing to ourselves. Can you really love a hologram? Can you really love an android? It's those kind of questions. Like, what does it mean? What does it mean to love? It's another one of those. I'm telling you, it's Dr. Zhivago with androids and holograms and flying cars. But I mean that in only the best way. I think you got to see it, and it's like, and I think that everybody will eventually see it in the comfort of their own home. But I think they're missing the widescreen, big screen, IMAX experience, as I like to call it sometimes. You have to see it on the big screen to get all the nuances.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, we keep talking about Hollywood and Hollywood's relationship to diesel punk. And, you know, I keep telling people, and I firmly believe this, that as a film and story aesthetic, the diesel punk aesthetic is the far more popular and prevalent, you know, if you want to call it not historical, but, you know, well, I guess it would be historical aesthetic. But I mean, you think about all of the movies that are coming out or have come out recently that fit our genre. You know, they're contemporary in origin. They have the aesthetics of the era, the decadence, as we call it. And they have some element of punk, be that, you know, the sci-fi, fantasy, alternate history, celebration of the anti-hero, etc. And there are a couple of movies coming out. You know, Blade Runner 2049 is out, but coming up, Larry, you had brought up Murder on the Orient Express. This is one I'm super excited about.
Oh, I am too. It's a remake of a remake, you know, of the great Agatha Christie novel by that name that was published back in 1934. This new movie is directed by the great Kenneth Branagh, and he stars as
Branagh.
Is it Branagh or Branagh?
Branagh. Branagh.
Is it Branagh?
Yeah.
Really?
Branagh.
I've never heard it pronounced. Okay.
I think a lot of us have been saying it wrong for years, Larry.
Kenneth Branagh. Okay. Yeah. Well, Branagh, he plays Hercule Poirot. But the list of names with him, Penelope Cruz, William Dafoe, Judi Dench, Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
Yes. Josh Gad, Derek Jacobi, Leslie Odom Jr., Michelle Pfeiffer, Daisy Ridley. Wow.
I just said, oh boy, that is quite a cast.
What a cast. I agree, Daisy. And, you know, William Dafoe has a diesel punk connection because he was in the diesel punk horror film Shadow of a Vampire. So there's a diesel punk connection with him.
Well, I've always maintained that Johnny Depp is one of us.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Without a doubt.
When you look at his personal style and the films he's chosen to be a part of, I mean, I think he is a diesel punk.
I want to interject here really quickly. I don't mean to interrupt you, Larry. But I think another one of those most misunderstood or underappreciated movies of in the last 10 years is the one with Christian Bale and Johnny Depp, Public Enemies. I'm telling you, it's one of those movies where it's like,
that's a great movie.
It is long and it is brutal, but the thing is that it was just like, it's such a great retrocentric diesel punk experience.
And it does border on being diesel punk in my opinion, because raises the questions of, you know, it's really the anti-hero, Dillinger, in some sense, is kind of portrayed as the anti-hero. It kind of does what Bonnie and Clyde was back in the 70s, where who are they really the bad guys? So,
hey, another. You mentioned it's starring and directed by Kenneth Branagh. Kenneth Branagh has done a lot of Diesel era period pieces as well.
Yes.
Swing Kids, I think, was the first thing I ever saw him in. Just recently, he was in Dunkirk, so he's got a pretty long history with this genre and these aesthetics as well.
Oh, and I forgot, he did make a diesel punk movie. He made a Love, Labor's Lost, because he does a lot of he started out as a Shakespearean actor, but it was set as a musical in the 1930s.
I've never seen this.
Yeah, it's one of the. You just don't see it very often, but yes, it was I saw it once on TV. It's set in the 1930s, specifically 1939, right at the outbreak of war, and it's done like an old Hollywood musical with singing and dancing and so forth. So I've always considered it to be a diesel punk movie because of that.
Wow. I'll have to find that one. I'm a huge fan of Kenneth Branagh. He's one of my favorite actors, and to see him play, I am probably the world's greatest detective. I'm super excited about that.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to the movie. So we can only hope that it has good success at the box office. I understand it's coming out in the U.S. and in Canada in November. I believe it's November 10th thing I saw. Okay, and it's a 20th Century Fox film. So, exciting stuff.
Yeah, and then in December, Christmas Day, is a new movie with Hugh Jackman about P.T. Barnum called The Greatest Showman. It looks grossly inaccurate, but a lot of fun. And it's kind of in that transitional era. You know, P.T. Barnum was active, most active in what we call that transition era or the interbellum period. Between steam and diesel, and so it's going to appeal to both sides of the fence. And then, have you guys seen the trailer for the new Guillermo del Toro movie, Shape of Water?
It looks incredible and terrifying and captivating all at the same time. Do you want to?
It looks great.
Do you want to go take a break and watch it and then come back?
Well, that doesn't come out until December either. But yeah, Larry, you need to see that trailer because, you know, Del Toro, he's another one I think is secretly one of us. Because you look at his movies like Hellboy,
Pacific Rim,
and Pan's Labyrinth. I mean, everything he does has a very diesel punk aesthetic to it.
Right, and those are diesel punk movies. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this one, I think he out-diesels his previous diesel. The aesthetics and it looks like the set of this laboratory, the idea that you get from the trailer is that they've captured this creature from the Black Lagoon kind of creature. Hmm. And the government is doing tests and studies on it, and there's this mute girl who is tasked with like cleaning the laboratory and maybe making sure that the creature is fed. I'm not exactly sure her full, but she ends up developing a relationship and falling in love with basically the creature from the Black Lagoon. Or if you've seen the Hellboy movies, Abe Sapien, he has that very same similar look and style to him. And the set of the laboratory looks like something out of the movie Metropolis.
It really does. It does have that sort of aesthetic to it, where it's like, oh my God, it's like it made me sit up and watch it, and it was like, it's almost as if Del Toro was able to tap into my nightmares as a child, and he's really sort of tapped in. The thing is that, I mean, not to bring up Mary Shelley. Every time I mention Mary Shelley, feel free to ring a bell or take a shot. But the whole thing about who's the monster? Like in the story of Frankenstein, who's the monster? Is it the creature, the creation, or the doctor who created the you know, and it, this creature,
or is it the people that encounter him?
Exactly. I mean, and with this Shape of Water, who's the most terrifying creature in this movie? Is it this poor little water creature that looks savage, looks mean and nasty, or is it the government officials experimenting on this poor creature? And it was, that's the kind of thing that it's like, we need more of that for us to sort of like dabble into what does it mean to be a human being.
Yeah, and so, you know, I say it every episode that this is a great time to be a fan of diesel punk, because we've got so much media coming out, so many things coming out. Now, if we could just get one of these studios, just one, to use the term diesel punk in their description. It's starting to happen in comics. We're starting to see that term actually used in marketing. In tabletop gaming, it's becoming more and more popular. If you're familiar with the game Scythe, Jamie Stegmaier, he's created a diesel punk board game, and he has, you know, that's what he's calling it. And you know, we're seeing that more and more in other forms of media, but golly, we just need one major Hollywood studio to call a new movie a diesel punk classic. And that would do it, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's really sort of what we need. But the thing is that it was just like, I'm sort of like okay with them not using the word diesel punk that much, because the thing is that, what have we complained about in the past? Diesel punk misappropriation. I don't want mm-hmm. people. I want us to define if a movie is diesel punk or not.
I feel a little bit that way, Eric. You know, I used to be really big on, you know, oh, if we could just make it big. Why can't we make it big where everybody knows diesel punk? And then I've kind of changed where I'm less concerned about that. Look at steampunk. There's a lot of those that are into steampunk. Back before, when, you know, as, you know, to paraphrase the country western song, there was steampunk before steampunk was cool. Okay. And they will tell you that it's not a good thing necessarily. So I'm not really that, you know, that big on anymore on wide scale knowledge or stuff being called diesel punk. It's just not anymore.
I don't think we want diesel punk to jump the shark. Daisy, you're being very quiet again. What do you think about diesel punk going mainstream this week?
Well, you know, a lot of people, they don't know the term, but honestly, if you start using the label diesel punk, then people are going to start kind of, I don't know. Because every time I have to explain diesel punk, everyone goes, oh, you mean it's like steampunk. But the thing with overusing a label is now, if you search, if like, say you go on Etsy, everything is steampunk on Etsy now. This used cheese grater, it's steampunk. Mm-hmm. It's steampunk. So, I mean, the aesthetics, I think the aesthetics appeal to a lot of people. A lot more people are diesel punks that don't know the term. I'm agreeing with y'all on that point. They're diesel punks and they don't even know it.
And I think that it's our job to get everybody equated and associated with the word diesel punk. I don't want to leave it up to, say, 20th Century Fox or Warner Brothers or anybody else to sort of like, because you know what, you had your chance and you missed it and you blew it. And now that we've taken on the mantle, you know what? You can help us out, but we don't want you to take over. And it's like I don't want the word diesel punk to be incorporated or corporized, or what's the word I'm looking for, when
trademarked, made into just a trend, you know?
Right, right.
Like, you don't want to go to, well, I mean, I wouldn't mind going to Michael's and seeing diesel punk craft items, but you know.
You know what? Diesel punk items are everywhere if you know how to look.
Now, I would like to have more variety in off the shelf and clothing. So that would be good.
Yeah.
But I think Daisy, and I think you have a good point. I think there's real risk of it being when it gets commodified and and the suits, which is funny because we are suits, aren't we, start taking over. But when the boardroom, let's say, starts taking Madison Avenue starts taking over, then we're gonna have some interesting conversations. And how can you market punk?
They tried and they failed and they ruined punk.
It's disaster.
Right. It's everything that goes against punk. Marketing is everything punk is trying to go against. I mean, you can't really market it.
That was one of the criticisms of the band Green Day.
Yes.
Was that they were accused of selling out the punk community. You know, I understand. I get like Johnny, you know, people, you just don't know what you're missing if it just would just kind of take off. And then it's like, I'm happy to be the one guy in the bar wearing a three-piece suit when everybody else is in a national uniform, you know.
There we go again with the national uniform. It's like somebody ring the bell, you know. But so anyway, one of the things I think that we also wanted to bring up tonight. I'm not sure if we lost Johnny or not.
No, I'm here. I've just been listening to you guys talk through that. You may have changed my mind on that. So I'll get back with you. I'll have my people call your people.
and we'll do lunch. I don't think that we want Madison Avenue and the corporate CEOs over at Madison Avenue and shareholders and whatnot. I don't think that we want to go public. I don't think we want Diesel Punk to go trading on the NASDAQ. But speaking of corporations and whatnot. So I came up with this theory the other day, or the other month, and it had occurred to me about why so many people like to say that all diesel punk has to be dystopic, as it were, if that's a word I can use. And I think that I finally figured it out. It was just like, as punks, diesel punks, we like to rebel. And this entire conversation in the past 5 or 10 minutes has been about open rebellion against the establishment and the oligarchs who want to impose the national uniform upon everybody. You know, the American socialist workers' uniform. And I think that's a huge issue that we're dealing with, is that we're fighting against the tide, and what they're trying to do is like sort of democratize fashion, if that makes any sense. By the way, you know what? I just got this message here Daisy, is there something that you wanted to bring up to the group before you have to bolt early on tonight?
Yeah, you know, we just we're having a little trouble over here at the hangar, but it'll all get sorted out. Well, I suppose I could talk about it a little tonight.
We need to hear your thoughts about the Tommy Gunn dolls.
The Tommy Gunn dolls. Oh my goodness. Well, I have to start by admitting something just a little embarrassing. A couple weeks ago, I got a package in the mail. I had no idea what it was. I remember looking at it, trying to figure out what it was, and then I opened it, and there it was in all its gorgeous, hardback, slick, full-color glory, was the Tommy Gunn Dolls Volume 1, The Big Knockover by Daniel Cooney. And now I have friends in the comics business. I know how much hard work and how much time goes into making comics, but to give you an idea of how long we've known about this project and how we've been waiting for it, I think, you know, if you know whether I'm wrong or not, Johnny, you can jump in, but I think one of the first podcasts that I was on over Skype was one where we talked with Daniel about the Tommy Gunn dolls. Didn't he join us for one of those ones back then?
He did. He was a guest on the show, and he's going to be back with us, by the way, in November.
Oh, right. Good.
But he, at that time, I had already known about the Tommy Gunn dolls since 2008.
Oh, well, I got to tell you this. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, he's been working on it for a long time.
Well, you can tell. It is a labor of love. It is beautiful. We've been waiting on this one, and it was worth it. The story, for those of you who haven't heard us talk about it before, I'll give you a very basic outline of the story. It follows a group of ragtag misfit girls, which that's one thing for me. A lot of them work in this nightclub. And they want to avenge the murder of a fellow burlesque dancer. And so they team up together and they go out to find answers and to get revenge. And brother, that right there is the kind of story you want to give me, because I'm all about those gorgeous dames kicking butt and taking names. And the illustrations, the pictures are beautiful. I got to give it up to comic artists, because writing and drawing on their own are hard enough, but when you are making a graphic novel, you have to do both of that. You know, you not only have to write your story, but you have to spend time working on the art to tell the story as well. You're telling the story two ways at once, and that's pretty amazing. But I like these gals, and I like that this is just volume one, which means hopefully we'll be seeing them again in the future. And this is, as I've said before, so far up my alley, it should have bought me a drink first.
Well, you know what I love about that story, though, Daisy, is that you pledged, because this was all funded on Kickstarter,
uh-huh.
And apparently you pledged to the Kickstarter and had completely forgotten about it.
I guess I had.
I love that, though. I'm a fly.
I have my head in the clouds. I'm a little airhead.
Well, Daniel will probably curse me on this, but, you know, I fell in love with this project in 2008. And I became one of his early evangelists for it, promoting it and just sharing the few sketches that he had done as concept art over the years, and really poking and prodding him, you know, privately and publicly to get this thing done. And when he launched the Kickstarter for it, I was one of the first couple backers of it. you know, I'm a big believer in this project. And you're right. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. And it's everything diesel punks love about, you know, storytelling and stories. But I got to ask this question, Daisy.
Yeah.
You know, have you found Big Daddy Cool in it yet?
You know,
Daniel swears to me. He swears to me that I make a cameo.
I've been looking, and I have not found Big Daddy Cool yet. But I'm gonna look again. I'm gonna read it again just to see if I can find you. Now that I've absorbed the story and the characters, I can start looking in the background to see if I see you.
Yeah, if you do, give me a heads up. I've not had a chance to, like, you know, dissect it, but I've looked. And golly, you know, that was his thank you to me for being such a stalwart supporter over the years. But yeah, it is a huge accomplishment. And, you know, Daniel, he's a working artist in the field. He does the the Star Wars Topps trading cards, and he's done a lot of commercial work, but this is his first successful self-published work. So kudos to him, and yep. It's fantastic. If you're into diesel punk comics, graphic novels, you have got to get this and put it on your bookshelf.
Or if you just like, or if you like looking at pretty flapper gals and like to see them kick butt, this is good for you too.
And who doesn't love that?
I don't know. Once you find them, let them know, and I better show them this.
Well, Daisy, if you have to run early before you go, I just want to let our audience know, speaking of watching and seeing beautiful kick butt dames on stage, you and I are going to be teaming up again for ShadowCon in January.
Yes, sir. I love ShadowCon. It is basically, the other conventions in Memphis, they're conventions, but ShadowCon really, it feels like a big, just a big family reunion for all the geek types in the area. So we're going to have a blast.
Yeah, and you and I are going to be performing along with Ginger O'Snap on the Friday night. We're going to do our Magic Cabaret show, and I can't wait to hear you sing and play again.
Well, I've been working on a couple different tunes, so I might bring something a little different to the stage this time, but, we'll see. We'll see how that turns out.
That'll be awesome. We'll talk more about that as we get closer, but while Daisy was with us, I wanted to mention that. So, Larry, Eric, what else you guys got on your plates?
I think that one of the things that I wanted to bring up here in lieu of... and I want to make absolutely, totally, perfectly clear, we're not going to get into the specifics of what's happened in Hollywood the past week or two, because I don't want, first of all, I don't want this conversation to devolve, and the thing is, this podcast is supposed to be fun and whatnot. We'll take on serious issues and all like that, but I think that viewing what's happened in Hollywood in the past couple of weeks has led me to this decision that we have to support small indie film studios, and we have to put our money where our mouth is when it comes to when people make movies that we really have to see, and they're low budget films or they're micro budget films and they're right up our alley. We should do everything that we can to support these people and take the power out of the power away from the power elite and the oligarchy in the media. And for this is another perfect example of this comic book, which is a labor of love, and I want it to have nothing but the greatest success. I want to know, can you subscribe to this comic via digital media? Can you get it online? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you it's available on Comixology, and you may be able to download it in a different format right at TommyGundolls.com. But the best way to own it is in hardcover graphic novel form. Are we still there?
I'm looking it up right now. And I'm going to buy my copy as soon as I'm done here. I'm going to buy a copy.
Excellent. Yeah. You'll love it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exactly what we need for women of Dieselpunk. We need more examples of strong, empowered women who do like to kick ass and take names. And I like the idea that women can be strong, beautiful, and intelligent and take care of their own. We need more of that.
Absolutely, we do. Absolutely. Larry, what about you? Anything else you wanted to bring to the forefront?
Well, not really, other than, you know, we need to remember history. And, you know, back on October 17th, which is when we're recording this, everybody, but back in 1931 on this date, Al Capone was convicted of tax evasion.
Aha! Uh-huh.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
A banner day in
And of course, American, you know, history. that makes me think of that great movie and great TV series, The Untouchables.
And
you know what? I may have to go watch that tonight.
I'm telling you, this is the 30th anniversary of The Untouchables movie, which was released in 1987.
Kidding me?
It's 30 years, Johnny.
That's 30 years. Believe.
It's held up well.
It's one of the best movies ever made.
Yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, it was released June 3rd, 1987. And I'll tell you something. Like, I remember when I was on a road trip with my dad and I saw on June 3rd, I said, "Dad, look, The Untouchables is playing at this theater." We pulled right in. It was a theater that we had never been to before. I don't think I could ever find it again. And we sat down and we watched it, and we loved every minute of it. And it was just like that was our thing. We would go and we would watch The Untouchables, you know, whenever we were on the road for a couple of months. It was an incredible film, and like you guys said, it holds up exceptionally well, but. I think that for me, tax evasion, you could only get Al Capone on tax evasion.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
And
when you read how it really went down, of course, you know, we talk about movies taking liberties with the facts.
Yeah.
And that movie takes some real liberties with the facts. It's actually quite amazing how they even got him on that.
I think that Larry, go ahead, finish your thought.
No, go ahead.
For me, I started a rant on the Fedora Chronicles about this very same topic. What is it? There's something about autumn that makes me really the biggest film noir fan out there for these months. And the thing is that when I run out of my stash of film noir, I sort of have to start mainlining true crime TV series and documentaries and stuff. And simultaneously, on Netflix right now, there are two based on a true story miniseries. One is called Manhunt Unabomber, and the other one is called Mindhunters. Say that one. Mm-hmm. You know, say that 10 times fast. And there's something fascinating and so film noir like about seeing men who are trying to get into the heads of criminals, serial killers, but not fall into the trap of becoming just like the people that they're hunting. Getting into the mind of somebody does not mean letting them take over your mind. And it's like that is just quintessential film noir, going to the dark side to figure out how the dark side thinks, and then trying to fight your way out of the dark side to reclaim your humanity. Those are two series. That's my latest addiction right now.
Well, you know, that's funny that you mentioned that, because that is one of the themes of The Untouchables.
Yes.
You know, Malone taking Ness over the garden wall, if you will, to think like Capone thinks. I hadn't really thought about that in those terms, but absolutely, that is one of the themes. And you know what? Just to kind of bring this conversation full circle, I saw Untouchables in 1987 on a Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock with me and my girlfriend at the time and my best friend Charlie and his girlfriend at the time. And it was just the four of us in the theater, and that was it. And what a magical moment. We've talked about this before for me, Eric. The Untouchables was one of the real defining moments that informed my personal aesthetic and style and really cemented me as a diesel punk before it was even a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember hunting down my first gray fedora to match a suit. It had peg legged and it was double breasted with a matching vest, and I thought I was the coolest cat in the neighborhood. And I think maybe I was.
Yeah, I think maybe you were. Yeah, I would have to say yeah. Big yes on that one. Big yes. Well, hey guys and gals, it is getting a little bit late, and we've had some fascinating discussion once again. A lot of cool stuff coming up. Again, I say it every week, and I mean it every time I say it. This is one of the best times to be a diesel punk, and it's only going to get better as more stuff happens and comes out, and that we can talk about and fall in love with. And I think there's a lot that we've wet the whistle of our or wet the appetite rather for our audience, and I can't wait to hear actual reactions on some of the things we've talked about: Blade Runner, Marston, Professor Marston, and the Wonder Woman, and Shape of Water, and Orient Express, and you know, Eric, I can't wait until you read the Tommy Gunn Dolls. I think that's just gonna it makes me want to do a dance, but I can't because I got this stupid foot injury. But we're not going to talk about that tonight. So, unless there's anything else, I think we can say goodnight.
I can't think of anything else.
Well, Larry, why don't you kick us off and sign us out?
All right. Well, Johnny, this has been fantastic. It seems like it's been forever. I tell you what, folks, I always point out something at the end, which is to check on your neighbors. And now that, they might not be talked about in the news, but they're still suffering. The people down in Houston, people in Florida, and Puerto Rico, and the West Coast. Check on your neighbors, because, take care of each other, because that's what life is all about.
Johnny, are you still there?
Hello,
I Jack. Am still here. I had you on mute. I was talking to you the entire time, and you didn't hear a word I said.
Not a word, my friend. Not a word.
Well, Daisy had to sign off, so Eric, you want to go ahead and say your farewells?
Not just my farewell, but a quick message and a quick antidote. I don't know who it was. I want to attribute it to Anne Fleming or the writer of the book, Being Bond. Every day you should go out and try something new that'll scare the crap out of you. And I did that today. I actually, I learned how to drive a forklift, of all things. And I was terrified and I was scared. And the amazing thing is that I actually moved some pallets around without killing anybody. No ambulances were needed or necessary. And I think that that's one of the things that life is really all about. Going out and taking a challenge. Do something that scares the crap out of you and master a skill. And while you're doing that, keep your chin up and your fedora on. Johnny?
Outstanding. And as always, on behalf of Daisy O'Dare, I will sign us out by saying once again, swing hard, swing often. We'll catch you on the flip side.